Trent's Last Case by E.C. Bentley, dramatized by Alan Downer, with Martin Jarvis as Trent. The year is 1913.
Editor's office.
I have a call for Sir James on an outside line.
I'm afraid Sir James is very busy this afternoon.
The gentleman says he's secretary to Mr. Sixby Manderson.
In that case, excuse me, Sir James.
Yes, Silver, what is it?
A man who claims to be secretary to Sixby Manderson wants to speak to you. I've said you're busy, but...
Not so busy I won't speak to Sixby Manderson's secretary.
Put the man on.
One moment, please. You're through.
Hello?
Sir James Molloy?
Speaking.
My name is Calvin Bunner. I'm speaking from the Manderson residence just outside Bishopsbridge.
How can I help you, Mr. Bunner?
I have some information for you. For exclusive use in your two newspapers. It's about Mr. Manderson.
Yes?
His body was found this morning in the grounds of this house.
His body?
He's been shot in the head.
Just a second, Mr. Bunner. Silver! Hunt up Figgis, young Williams, the infallible Mrs. Morgan, and someone from the business section. Assemble them in the conference room now.
Right, ladies and gentlemen, your full attention, please.
Sixby Manderson has been murdered. Consequently, we'll be bringing out a special edition this evening and a full story in the Record tomorrow. Williams,
sir,
instruct Mr. Anthony to prepare for a two-column opening that will knock the town endways. Tell him to take all measures and precautions for a scoop. Say that Figgis will be over in 5 minutes with the full story.
Yes, sir.
And then come straight back.
Yes, sir.
You ready, Figgis?
Sir.
Sixby Manderson and his wife, with two secretaries, have been for the past fortnight at the house called White Gables at Marlstone near Bishopsbridge. He bought it 4 years ago, and he and Mrs. Manderson have been in the habit of spending part of each summer there. Last night, he went to bed at 11:30 as usual. No one knows what time he got up and left the house, but his body was discovered at 10 o'clock this morning by one of the gardeners. It was lying by a shed in the grounds of the house. He had been shot through the left eye, and death must have been instantaneous. Dr. Stock of Marlstone will conduct a post-mortem examination. So far, the police have no clue as to the identity of the murderer. Got that?
Yes, sir.
Well, knock some shape into it and we're away.
Yes, sir. How about this for a headline? Napoleon of Wall Street murdered.
How about murder of Sixby Manderson? Keep it simple.
Yes, right.
Anything else?
Yes. How about one of the ablest detectives at Scotland Yard has been put in charge of the case?
It's a safe statement. Why not?
And Mrs. Manderson, was she there?
She was.
Then how about some human interest? She's prostrated by shock and is seeing no one.
I don't think so, Mr. Figgis. Forgive me, Sir James.
Mrs. Morgan?
I once saw Mrs. Manderson, and she looked quite healthy and intelligent. She won't be prostrated by shock, I don't think. She'll be more likely to be doing all she can to assist the police.
I'm on my way, then.
Yes, cut along. Mr. Anthony is expecting you. And use his private office. At this stage, we can't be too discreet.
Sir.
Right, it's your turn, Mrs. Morgan. I expect you know what I want from you.
I did anticipate something of the kind, Sir James, so I've come prepared. Mm-hmm. Our Manderson biography is well up to date. Would you like to see it?
Please. And if you've a copy for Mr. Edison here.
Of course. It's a touch hyperbolic, perhaps. All that about having been the foe of the raiding chieftains that infest the borders of Wall Street.
Edison, what do you think?
Well, I'm sure of one thing. The moment this news gets out, the bottom will fall out of Wall Street.
Well, you'd agree with this, then. To speak the name of Manderson was to call up a vision of all that was broad-based and firm in the vast wealth of the United States?
Absolutely. They don't call him the Colossus for nothing.
That's not all they called him.
What?
Miners, steelworkers, cattlemen. Tens of thousands of workers all across America and elsewhere had every reason to curse his name.
He smashed a strike or two, yes.
Using methods that were both ruthless and lawless.
Always in pursuit of legitimate business ends.
Forgive me, Mr. Edison, but only a finance editor would find that a valid excuse.
That's below the belt, Mrs. Morgan.
I assure you, Sir James, that none of my personal views about Manderson will find their way into his obituary. Shall we go on?
Please do.
You will see that the salient biographical details are as follows. Born in New York in 1860 and given the best education that money can buy. Mm-hmm. As a young man, went into business on his own account and soon won the dubious reputation of being an infant prodigy in the field of financial speculation. A gambler of genius, pitting his wits against all comers in the dogfight of the New York Stock Exchange.
And mostly coming out on top.
Quite. When his father died in 1889, Manderson took over the family banking business and changed overnight, turning his back on Wall Street, and by hard work and keen brain, winning control of the company and a reputation as a pillar of the financial establishment.
A poacher turned gamekeeper, you might say.
In 1907, he met and married Mabel Domecq, an English lady barely half his age. Mm. There are no children.
And so on and so forth. Right, Mrs. Morgan, let's print it.
You said I was to report back, Sir James.
Yes, Williams, thank you. I just want you to stand by and give Mrs. Morgan a hand.
Yes, sir.
Have we any photographs?
No shortage of those. I'll send a selection down to you at once and you can choose.
Excellent.
We also have two very good portraits. One, a sketch by Mr. Trent, when they were fellow passengers on the same ship somewhere. It's a splendid likeness.
You know our public, Mrs. M. They always prefer a bad photograph to a good drawing. But on the subject of Trent, Silver.
Yes, sir?
Get him on the telephone for me now, will you?
Yes, sir.
You're putting him on the case, Sir James?
I don't think he'll take much coaxing. Come along, Edison. We'll discuss the financial aspect as we go.
Right, Sir James.
Who is this Mr. Trent, then?
Philip Trent?
Hmm.
A painter. His pictures sell, what's more. Early 30s. Handsome, full of fun.
A painter? So what have you want with him?
A few years ago, there was a murder committed in a railway train in very puzzling circumstances. Trent applied his mind to the case and later sent a long letter to Sir James because his newspaper had, as usual, contained the fullest and most intelligent version of the facts. Oh, pass me those photographs, would you?
Certainly.
And in his letter, Trent did what Poe had done in the case of the murder of Mary Rogers.
Oh, yeah?
With nothing but the newspapers to guide him, Trent drew attention to the significance of certain apparently negligible facts so as to throw grave suspicion onto a man who had presented himself as a witness. Sir James printed the letter and in the next edition was able to announce the arrest and full confession of the incriminated man.
Well, well.
Since then, Sir James has paid Mr. Trent large sums to unravel similar problems for the paper, at home and abroad. And he's been amazingly successful. However, Mr. Trent always returns to his painting.
Oh, let's hope he'll solve this one for us then, eh?
I'm sure he will. Sadly, if he travels by train, which is his usual preference, he won't be in Marlston till breakfast time tomorrow. The only good train left half an hour ago. The next is a slow one leaving Paddington at midnight.
You know your Bradshaw by heart, do you, Mrs. Morgan?
A good newspaper man, Williams, is supposed to know everything.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes?
You're Mr. Trent, aren't you? Mr. Philip Trent?
Yes, that's right.
I recognise you from your photographs. I'm a great fan. And something of an amateur sleuth myself. The way you solved that murder at Ilkley, I really don't know how you did it. Quite spectacular.
Oh, thank you. I'm afraid you have the advantage of me, Mr.
Abbott.
Abbott?
Henry Abbott. I'm manager of the Castle Hotel. The newspaper telephone booked you a room. Said you'd be arriving on this train.
Indeed. And you very thoughtfully came to collect me. Well, I'm most indebted, Mr. Abbott.
All night journeys aren't much fun, are they? Oh, well, can I take your bag, sir?
Thank you very much. Oh, I'm quite fond of railway travelling, as a matter of fact. It has a certain appeal. I am the stoker and the stoked.
I am the song the porter sings. Beg your pardon, sir?
It's nothing. It doesn't matter. Oh, I have packed for a longish stay, I'm afraid. One never knows with these matters.
Are you immediately hungry for your breakfast, sir?
Why do you ask?
Because I thought you might like to drive to the hotel via Dr. Stock's surgery.
Oh?
It's the last chance you'll have to see the body. It's to be post-mortem this morning.
Are you able to arrange it?
It's a mighty regular, sir, but one is not without one's influence in the village. It's all laid on already, and the doctor's waiting.
As you'll observe, Mr. Trent, the shot in the eye scarcely disfigured the face at all and caused scarcely any effusion of blood.
Hmm. Nor are there any powder burns visible, indicating he was not shot at close range.
Quite so, Mr. Abbott.
And, to my mind, eliminating the possibility of suicide.
Besides which, no weapon was found near the body.
And whoever heard of a suicide shooting himself through the eye?
Oh, good point, Mr. Trent, good point.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Abbott, thank you. Now, what interests me more are his wrists.
What about them?
See these bruises and scratches.
I'd observed them, of course, at my initial examination.
Suggestive of a struggle, I'd say.
That's what it looks like. Also of interest are his shirt cuffs.
In what way, sir?
Well, with someone dressed as formally as this, you'd expect the cuffs to be well down over the wrists. Well,
perhaps in the struggle.
Possibly. Now, you gentlemen must have seen something of him on his previous visits to White Gables. Would you have called him a well-dressed man?
I'd have called him a swell.
Yes, he was always quite fastidious in his dress.
Because there's something else that's rather odd. Look at his shoelaces.
My word, those laces were tied in a hurry.
That's my point about the cuffs. They're dragged up inside the coat sleeves as if he'd hurried into his coat without pulling them down. That's why the wrists are visible.
He parted his hair carefully enough.
Yeah, that parting's a work of art.
Also, if he was in a hurry, why did he put on so much? Complete outfit of underclothing, studs in the shirt, sock suspenders, a watch, chain, money, key.
Why, indeed.
On the other hand...
What?
He'd neglected to put in his false teeth.
It doesn't add up.
And there's something else.
What?
His watch. It's in the wrong pocket. Look, one of the waistcoat pockets is lined with wash leather to accommodate a watch. But he'd put his into the pocket on the other side.
And what do you deduce from that?
Oh, nothing for the present, Doctor. I must reconnoitre the ground first. Well, gentlemen, thank you both for your invaluable assistance.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, I think it's time for breakfast.
My dear Trent, I was half expecting you.
Well, well, well. Nathaniel Burton Cupples. How are you, my best of friends?
I'm tolerably well, thank you. Oh, you're looking splendid. Will you join me for breakfast?
Oh, rather. I've worked up quite an appetite. Wait up. Yes, I'll start with grapefruit, and then I think a sole.
Yes.
But I shan't eat again till this evening, very likely. I expect this to be a hard day.
I take it you've come down to write about the murder.
Oh, that's rather a colourless way of putting it. I should prefer to say I'm here to hunt down the guilty and vindicate the honour of society. I've had one slice of luck already. I've been allowed to view the body. Now I must somehow manage to get on the right side of the people at the house.
Well, that is precisely the point on which I can be of assistance to you. Now, allow me to explain. Mrs. Manderson is my niece.
What? Cupples, are you jesting with me?
No, I'm perfectly serious. Her father, John Peter Domecq, was my late wife's brother. Now, she's bearing up wonderfully well, Trent. She has remarkable fortitude of character.
Grapefruit, sir?
Thank you.
And will it be tea or coffee?
Tea, please. A large pot.
Very good, sir.
Now, will your niece allow me to see her?
Well, she has a great horror of the newspapers. And is doing her utmost to keep journalists away. But I mentioned that you might be down and told her you were a personal friend. And it ended with her saying that if you should come, she would like you to be helped in every way. However, she will prefer not to see you herself just yet. She's keeping to her own sitting room. She's been interviewed by a detective from Scotland Yard and feels unequal to any more.
I quite understand.
Now, there are two secretaries and Martin the butler, who she thinks can tell you all you want to know.
Cupples, is there anything about this business that you know and would rather not tell me?
Well, what on earth do you mean?
I mean about the Mandersons. What strikes me as odd about this affair is that here is a man, a famous man, suddenly and violently killed, and nobody's heart seems broken. Doctor, hotel manager, have been his neighbours for years, both spoke about him as coolly as though they'd never set eyes on him.
Well, the truth is that nobody liked Manderson, and those who were nearest to him liked him least of all. As for my niece, I know her to be an amiable and honourable woman, but for some time past, Manderson had made her miserable.
In what way?
She said it was as if he were nursing a perpetual grievance. He maintained a distance between them and would say nothing.
And this estrangement had been going on for how long?
Oh, several months. At last, a week ago, she wrote asking me to come down and talk to him on her behalf. She was adamant she wouldn't do so herself, so I agreed. I refused to go to White Gables, disapproving, as I do, of the use to which Manderson on several notorious occasions put his vast industrial power, so I watched my opportunity and met him as he passed by this hotel. We spoke just inside the gate there.
And?
Well, I told him what Mabel had confided in me and asked how he could justify his behaviour towards her.
How did he receive that?
Not very well. He told me not to butt in. said Mabel was well able to take care of herself, as he had found out, among other things. I insisted he explain. He refused. He said, this thing has gone far enough, I guess. And he turned to go.
Did he mean your interview?
Oh, you'd think so, wouldn't you, from the words alone? But it was the way he uttered them, and the fierce light in his eye. I received the impression he'd formed some sinister resolve.
Good heavens. What did you do?
I flew into a rage. I love my niece, and in the heat of the moment I said a number of foolish things at the top of my voice and within earshot of several of the hotel guests, concluding with a statement that I thought him unfit to live.
not very typical of you couples.
No, but at least it relieved my mind.
And Manderson?
He smiled slightly, but I could see a vein swelling in his forehead. It's not a pleasant sight. Then he turned away and strolled off towards White Gables.
And this happened...
on Sunday morning.
And you never saw him again?
No. Or rather, yes, once, later in the day, on the golf course. But I didn't speak to him. And next morning he was found dead. I tell you all this, my friend, because I fear that you will find it out for yourself and suspect Mabel of having had something to do with the crime, and that's simply not possible.
Mm. So? Thank you. Well, it'll be a shame to hurry this. It looks delicious. But I'm being paid a vast sum by Sir James to solve a murder. I must get over to White Gables.
What will you do first?
Visit the scene of the crime, I think. The spot where the body was found. Something might turn up.
Mr. Trent, I presume? Oh, did I give you a start? I'm sorry.
That's all right.
My name is John Marlowe. I'm Mr. Manderson's personal secretary.
Ah, yes.
Mr. Cupples telephoned from the hotel. You are expected.
Oh, good.
Have you found any clues?
Not one. I've ransacked the hut. I've covered every inch of the ground. Nothing at all. It's a terrible business, Mr. Marlowe.
Yes.
You look worn out.
I was driving the car all Sunday night and most of yesterday, and I didn't sleep well last night after hearing the news.
Who would?
Indeed. Listen, I'll have to leave you now. I have to arrange about the inquest. But if you go up to the house and ask for Mr. Bunner, he'll look after you.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, there's a detective here already. Inspector Murch from Scotland Yard.
Inspector Murch, eh?
He arrived yesterday. He's in the library.
You didn't waste any time, Inspector.
Ah, Mr. Trent.
I did think I was ahead of Scotland Yard this time. How did you get here so soon?
I was on leave with the missus at Halvey, 12 miles down the coast. I bicycled over yesterday evening.
So you have the head start.
Oh, I don't mind bringing you up to date. I know you'd do the same for me if the positions were reversed. Seen the body?
Oh, yes, yes, thank you. And the place where it lay?
You haven't wasted very much time yourself.
So, what are your first impressions?
It's all very puzzling. Now, to start with, I guessed it might be common robbery and murder by some tramp. But there's not the slightest trace of any attempt at burglary, and the body wasn't robbed. My second thought was suicide.
Ah.
But, as I'm sure you'll agree, Mr. Trent, the facts are all against it.
Hmm. So, who do you suspect?
Everybody. At this stage of affairs, it's the only safe principle. Now, first of all, there's Mrs. Manderson.
Yes?
Seems she and Mr. Manderson weren't getting along so well just lately. And she was the last person he spoke to as he retired for the night. They occupied adjoining rooms, you see.
You have looked over them?
Yeah. It's interesting. Him being a millionaire, you'd think he'd have gone in for luxury. But his bedroom's bare. Almost like a cell. It opens onto his wife's room. Now, not much of a cell about that, I can tell you. There's a lady who enjoys the pretty things in life.
Hmm. What about this room?
Oh, they call it the library. Manderson used to do his writing in here. I've been through the desk this morning with the American secretary. Bunner, his name is, and a queerer card I never saw turned. Now, he's got it into his head that his boss had been receiving threatening letters and that the murder was the outcome of that.
Any evidence?
None at all. All we found were business letters, reports, prospectuses in there, just what you'd expect.
Mm.
The only unusual thing we found were some packets of banknotes to a considerable amount and a couple of little bags of unset diamonds.
Diamonds?
Seems Manderson had begun buying diamonds lately as a speculation. A new game, Bunner said. I told him to put them in a safer place.
Mm, good. Now, what did Manderson want with two secretaries?
I asked him the same question. The arrangement was that Bunner was his right-hand businessman, one of his office staff, whereas Marlowe looked after his motors and yacht and horses and sporting arrangements and that.
I see.
The last member of the staff to see Manderson alive was Martin the butler. I had his story last night and very glad he was to tell it. A fair like this is meat and drink to the likes of him. Would you like to talk to him?
If it wouldn't bore you to hear what he has to say again.
Well, they say suffering is good for the soul.
I last saw Mr. Manderson...
No, please, not that yet. Tell me all you saw of him that evening. After dinner, sir.
After dinner, sir? Yes. I recall that after dinner, Mr. Manderson and Mr. Marlowe walked up and down the path through the orchard talking.
Have you any idea what they were talking about?
Well, it seemed important because I heard Mr. Manderson say, as near as I can remember, if Harris is there, every minute is vital. You want to start right away, and not a word to anyone. Mr. Marlowe answered, very well, I'll just change out of these clothes and I'm ready. Or words to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Marlowe then went up to his bedroom and Mr. Manderson came in here and rang for me. He handed me some letters for the postman in the morning and observed that Mr. Marlowe had persuaded him to go for a drive in the car by moonlight.
What time was this?
About ten, sir, I should say. Mr. Manderson then joined Mrs. Manderson in the drawing room, which struck me as curious, as I had not known him enter that room since we came to White Gables this year, preferring to remain alone in here. However, he did only remain with Mrs. Manderson for a few minutes, then he and Mr. Marlowe drove off in the direction of Bishopsbridge.
And did you see Mr. Manderson again later?
About an hour later, yes, sir, and once again here in the library.
He rang for you?
Yes, sir. Said he wanted someone to sit up until 12:30 in case an important message should come through by telephone. And he requested me to do this since Mr. Marlowe had driven to Southampton for him in the motor. He said I was to take the message down if it came, but on no account was I to disturb him.
And that was all?
He ordered a fresh siphon of soda water.
Mm. You noticed nothing unusual about him? He didn't appear worried, ill at ease?
No, sir. When I answered his ring, he was seated by the telephone, and when I returned with the siphon, he was engaged in conversation over the wire.
Excuse me, sir.
What is it, Sergeant?
Dr. Stocks just sent something up for you, sir. Something private.
Ah, yes, right. Excuse me for a moment, Trent.
Yes, of course. To continue, do you remember anything of what Mr. Manderson was saying on the telephone?
Something about somebody being at some hotel.
Hmm. And that was the last you saw and heard of him alive?
No, sir. At about 11:30, I heard him go up to bed. I myself sat up till 12:30, as instructed, but no message came.
Sorry about that.
Oh, not at all. Martin, did you hear Mr. Manderson re-enter the house after returning from his drive in the car?
No, sir. His ringing the bell in this room was the first I knew of his being back. He must have come in by the French window.
If I may.
Inspector?
That does seem likely. There's a footprint in the soft new gravel just outside. It exactly matches the patent shoes Manderson wore that night.
I see.
And he still had his hat on, I remember, and had thrown his greatcoat over the end of that table where he'd placed a decanter of whiskey, a siphon and a glass. He kept them in that cupboard.
Hmm. Was he a heavy drinker?
Oh, on the contrary, sir. He was a remarkably abstemious man.
This cupboard?
Yes, that's right, sir.
Yes. About the whiskey, did Mr. Manderson take a drink that night?
I couldn't say, sir. I know the decanter was nearly full that evening. I'd refilled it a day or so before.
It's half empty now.
How extraordinary.
Well, that's how it was this morning.
I don't understand it. Most days he never drank a drop.
The servants, perhaps?
Out of the question. The women servants never touch anything. I can answer for it. And when I want a drink, I can help myself without going to the decanter.
Thank you. Now, about Mr. Manderson's clothing. I suppose he had dressed for dinner that night?
Oh, certainly, sir. He had on a suit with a dress jacket, which he usually wore when dining at home.
And he was dressed like that when you saw him last?
All but the jacket, yes, sir. When he spent the evening in the library, as usually happened of late, he would change it for an old tweed shooting jacket. When I last saw him, he was wearing that.
I see. Now, to the following morning, I understand that Mr. Manderson was not missed until the body was found about 10 o'clock.
That is so, sir. Mr. Manderson was never called in the morning, nor did he have anything brought up to him. And quite often he would sleep till 9 or 10 o'clock.
And you yourself heard nothing in the night? No pistol shot, no sounds of struggle?
Oddly enough, sir, nothing. I am a light sleeper, and my bedroom is on the side of the house nearest to where Mr. Manderson's body was found, but no, I heard nothing.
Nor did you hear him leave the house at whatever time it was the following morning?
No, sir.
One final question. Were the clothes in which the body was found the clothes which Mr. Manderson would naturally have worn that day?
Another oddity, sir. I must answer yes and no. The brown suit was one of a dozen he might have worn, but otherwise...
Yes?
Well, he had put on all the same things he had worn the night before. Large fronted shirt and all. It was quite unprecedented. And shows to my way of thinking what a hurry he must have been in when getting up, because normally...
Thank you. That is all for the moment. Though you can point us in the direction of Mr. Manderson's bedroom.
As you say, Murch, for the apartment of a plutocrat, it is strangely bare.
Yeah. It's all been left as it was on the morning the body was discovered.
Indeed. Bed unmade.
Oh, teeth in a glass on the bedside table. Scattered articles of clothing. Dressing table in some disorder.
As you might expect of a man who was dressing in a hurry.
Now, where are these patent leather shoes you spoke of?
In this cupboard, sir, right hand side.
And these?
Are the offending articles. Manderson left them outside the door as usual for the maid to clean.
She didn't clean them all that well. Look, a faint trace of red gravel in the angle between the heel and the instep.
Yes, it matches the gravel outside the French window.
Where you found the footprint?
Correct.
That is strange.
What?
There's a slight split in the leather here, where the two laced parts of the shoe join the upper. Same in both shoes. Stitching is slightly parted.
Very slightly, yes.
Also, slight straining of the stitches where the uppers join the sole.
Well, as Martin said, he wore them every evening. You'd expect a certain amount of wear and tear.
Perhaps. Let's take a look next door.
It's another world in there.